She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And thank you so much for joining us to think today. The show is sponsored by Chapman Tucson. Thank you so much for your support of the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. I promise you a content-rich and informative show today. We are going to interview Richard Fuller, who's the president of the Blacksmith Institute, an international organization that works with some of the world's most polluted places, and they do it by sharing resources and expertise with local groups and agencies to solve pollution problems, to clean up the polluted sites, which all ultimately saves lives, and from where I sit, makes our world a healthier place. Rich, welcome so much, and thank you for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to be a part of the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network.
It's my pleasure.
So let me just do a quick shout out. Please remember to join me every Saturday at noon, Pacific Standard Time at MrsGreensWorld.com, where I do interview guests like Rich that can bring you a global perspective of what's going on with our environment, all kinds of sustainability issues. You can listen on your iPhone or Droid. All of the podcasts from the shows are available within 2 days on my website, right there for your listening pleasure. And I have to do a little sponsor shout out for a company, and it seems to me how it always fits in with the guest in some way. One of my newest sponsors is actually an international company called EcoBella, and they're a pioneer in the natural beauty and safe cosmetics industry. And it's always important for me to look at my partners as hard as they look at me because of an aligned intention. And I did quite a bit of research on EcoBella before trying their products. And one of the things that made me really, really, really happy and a big green light was they have some of the highest ratings by the Environmental Working Group's cosmetic database. And as many of you know who've been with me for quite some time, the Center for Safe Cosmetics is simply an independent group of scientists that do research and report on what they find. Then they rate the safety of their cosmetics and everything that you put on your body, from sunscreen to shampoo and conditioner. And they just report the findings, how toxic-free they are, and also having a minimal amount of impact on the planet. So I encourage you to do your own research about toxins on the many things that you put on your body. Again, it's a life-saving tip. And to check out EcoBella's website at ecobella.com to compare their standards of what you might be using. And I don't say this lightly, the life you save may be your own, which is a perfect segue to our guests, Rich Fuller, who is the founder and president of the Blacksmith Institute. And you know, Rich, I don't usually do this, but if it's okay with you, I want to give a little bit about your background, because it was surprising to me that you went from a degree in engineering, and maybe you can fill in the blanks and illuminate me here, from the Wellburn Institute with IBM. And you left in Australia in 1988 to work on global environmental issues. So you've spent time in Brazil working for the United Nations environmental programs. You've created forest reserves. I mean, talk about a champion of, I will be one of your absolute, I'll be in the Rich Fuller fan club. But how do you segue from an IBM engineer to major environmental impact organization? Tell me a little bit about that. I think there's a little missing synapse for me, and a wonderful one, I'm sure.
Well, it's actually quite useful to have a corporate background and that pragmatic, get it done kind of quality when you're actually going out and looking to do something in the philanthropic world. And, you know, mostly when people think about philanthropic activities, they think of advocacy. And people that are very good at speaking and bringing attention to issues and trying to raise public awareness. And my organization is not in that field. It's instead, it's in the field of actually fixing and solving problems. and trying to do that at scale. So that works well for someone who's got a corporate background, who's used to solving real-world problems and moving on and doing the next one.
So that answers it. I mean, it really does, and I could not agree with you more. I mean, there are lots of challenges in the nonprofit sector, and a lot of that is because of the lack of a corporate mindset. Run it as a business, and it'll work. So I could not agree with you more. You have offices in New York, London, and India, and I saw on your website, coming soon, China and Russia. What's your, just talk about the Blackwell Institute.
Actually, we have offices in 17 countries. We just don't list them all necessarily, but we are active in 47 countries around the world and with representatives in 17. So we're all through Africa, in Tanzania, Senegal, Latin America, Mexico, Dominican Republic, as well as places, you know, Russia, China, India, the Philippines, Kyrgyzstan, and so on and so forth. So our website is probably a little bit out of date there, I think.
But the information about those countries is on there. I can tell you that. There are so many stories of successes and what you're doing, the projects you have been involved in, and that what you're involved in. I wasn't aware that you had such extensive, like, physical presence in those countries, so I apologize for that. So tell us about the mission and the purpose of the Blacksmith Institute.
Sure. So Blacksmith was created back in 1999, when it became clear that this problem of pollution throughout the developing world was really not particularly well addressed. And what we've noticed over the last several decades is industry and mining being shipped overseas. So it's not just call centers, but it's all that manufacturing, especially the dirty manufacturing,
right,
has been shipped overseas because we've gotten very tight laws and expenses and all the rest of it, and these countries don't. So mining can be done in Peru or in China or Cambodia without anyone paying any attention to basic environmental controls and regulations. And the same with industry. So we found that these brown spots, we call it the brown agenda versus the green agenda, which is biodiversity, is completely under-addressed throughout the developing world. And it's one of those international gaps, if you like, in the development agenda that needed to be filled. And so that's what Blacksmith has stepped into.
And you, the magnitude and scope, when we spoke earlier, when I was just getting ready to prepare for the show, paint a picture as best you can of the magnitude and scope of the sheer numbers and the volume of the problem in terms of sites and toxicity and the hundreds of millions of people impacted.
Right. So what we have been doing over the last 5 years is identifying places where there are toxins. And for us, these are things like lead, mercury, cadmium, radionuclides, pesticides, dioxins, and other things that we know damage people and kill them. Where there are toxins at levels that exceed US EPA standards by a factor of at least 5.
Okay.
So these are places that we know people will be dying early or getting sick. And in many cases, we see that evidentially in these places. So we've been identifying these sites all around the world. We've got about 2,500 sites in that database. And we think that's only the tip of the iceberg. But when we extrapolate and look to the effect in terms of the gross number of people affected, it's over 150 million people who are exposed to toxins at dangerous levels. To put that in perspective, tuberculosis has 14 million people who are exposed at any time. Malaria is around 200 million people. HIV is 35 million people. So the scope of the exposure here is something that's comparable to all of these other diseases, but it's not something that's commonly thought about.
And
so
We
have places out there where 500 children have died in a matter of a few weeks from acute lead poisoning, or life expectancy is less than 45 from just general toxic exposures to different kinds of pollutants. And when we compare the problem to what went on in the U.S. back in the 60s and 70s, when we started all the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts, it's a similar kind of thing, but at a much larger scale. You know, we all talk about Love Canal, and that was a tragedy that, you know, created the Superfund and did all kinds of marvelous things for the U.S. But there's 7,000 or 8,000 sites like that, many of which are 100 times worse or 1,000 times worse in terms of the net health impact all throughout the developing world.
And, you know, I would think that as I am sure that if I called anybody from NRDC or, you know, World Health or whatever, they certainly know about the work of the Blacksmith Institute. There would be no question about that. But why is it because it's so diluted and the geographical spread is so wide that it doesn't come together as a big message that people are aware? Because you say HIV, everybody knows about that. You say malaria, people are terrified. But toxic pollution, from where I sit 4 years later, it's one of those that's continuously ignored and continuously has to happen, even in the United States. I mean, I had the beach report on last week from the NRDC, and we've got some really serious at-risk oceans. But again, like, why isn't the bell, you know, why aren't we ringing the danger bell here? Well, as a global community?
Yeah, the simple answer is that this is new knowledge, that no one's ever done this analysis. No one's ever actually gone out to try and look at this. We know there's Bhopal and Chernobyl and a few other places, but looking into the backyards and the suburbs of these urban centers and trying to find these places and trying to understand that that particular neighborhood of 10,000 people has an abandoned battery recycling facility where the lead levels are 100,000 times US EPA standards, and, you know, 50 kids probably die each year from it. Those statistics don't get into the municipal records. They're not attributed to that particular toxin,
right,
and there's not
right.
much knowledge there. And it needs us to go out and find these places and understand it. And this research of actually finding these places and doing this, this is all completely brand new. And by the way, our partners in this, one of our key partners is World Health Organization and NRDC as well. It's lovely you mentioned both those. But our other partners are the World Bank, the United Nations Environment Program, UNIDO, which is the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, and the European Union. So this is not done as an NGO, you know, without resources. This is done with a pretty broad, detailed technical analysis.
Some pretty global heavy hitters, I might add. So you've got a vast network, clearly.
Yeah.
And they get it. Yeah. I mean, it's an informed network. Well, I'm interested in terms of the NRDC because their focus primarily is in the United States. So how do you partner with them? They're one of my favorite and among my most frequent guests on my Saturday show because they always want us to cover something.
Yeah, and they're lovely folk, and they do have a small international program, and they focus a lot in China on helping companies in southern China work to improve their performance, and they're having some great successes there. So we work with them closely in that territory where we have obviously quite a lot of work going on. And we continue to, you know, work with them. Their executive director is one of our advisors.
Right, I did see that. So what about let's get like from the global to the one specific example. First of all, how do you find out about a situation like 500 kids dying? Is it the vast network that you have activated? Do people actually know because of your global presence to contact you? And then how do you assess, okay, folks, we're taking this on, but this one really doesn't make the cut? How do you decide to start working on a project? And then give us a little idea what the process looks like. How do you start building the partnership with the community that has an investment in the outcome?
Lots of questions. Bits of it in time. Just one project example in the northern part of Nigeria, in a state called Zamfara, very poor. It's an Islamic stronghold The women live in compounds and barely leave those compounds, and also a place where cattle and cattle rearing are the predominant activity. And average income per person is at that $1 or $2 per day kind of subsistence level. They found a body of ore that had gold in it nearby, and the imam, the head religious leader of the region, suggested that people bring that ore home and crush it and process it at home so that people can make money. And sure enough, people doing this are making now $5 and $6 a day. It's a terrific economic growth potential for the region. The problem, though, is that the ore is very heavy in lead. So while it has gold in it, it's also 20% lead. So they would crush it and process it and throw the residual into their backyards where their kids were playing. And these kids would take in lead at levels that, were fatal. So we found out about this because Doctors Without Borders, who's also a fabulous partner, they were doing a vaccination run through the area, and they came to some of these small towns or villages, and there were no children to vaccinate. There were just rows and rows of graves. And the locals had no idea why, and it took MSF a little bit of time to work it out. But when they did, they contacted WHO, who, 10 minutes later called us, and we sent a team out there straight away to work out what to do, and we cobbled together some quick funding, some emergency funding, and sent out some technical people to start to remediate these backyards and train people in how not to do this and how not to kill their kids. So, it's been 2 years since we started to work there, and we still need to do a lot more work, but at least we've cleaned up 7 of the worst of the villages, and MSF has set up camp there to treat the children that are most at risk of dying with chelation therapy, and continue to do that work, and we're continuing to move forward.
But when you say, tell me a little bit about, I am intensely curious about the advanced team. Like, you just literally, it's kind of like landing on Mars, even though I know you're sending people with an incredible amount of experience, but how do you decide this is the team we're going to send in, and what do they start doing first? Because you talked about the kind of community it was. There are such cultural issues, boundaries, not exposed to our world, to the Western world. How do you start? Just give me a little idea of what does the advanced team look like?
Well, first, we're supported by a volunteer technical advisory board.
Okay.
And this is about 40 or plus more technical experts who are, the gray-haired top dogs in their field. They come, it's a head of epidemiology from Harvard University. It's a head of environmental sciences from MIT. It's the former retired guy who started the largest environmental engineering firm in the world, and so on and so forth. These are all people who really know this particular problem. So the very first step for us when we have an emergency response like that one is to shout out to the people that are specific to this particular problem within their technical advisory board and say, what do we do next? Because, we don't pretend to have this knowledge in-house. We're as small as possible within our back office operations and spending as much money as possible in the field. We don't like any overhead. And then they say, get us out there with this kind of equipment and we'll work out what to do next. So that was what we did. We sent out a bunch of folk who really understood lead toxicity. And these were people that had done the largest lead cleanup in the U.S. And done it successfully. And they've been there ever since, along with other experts from other sites and other technical experts from different kinds of problems. So, you end up kind of creating a community of people who can work there in conjunction with the local agencies.
And activating a huge network. And believe it or not, I told you when we spoke this morning that the time was going to fly, and it will, because we're getting ready to go to our first break, and we'll come back. And I'd like to talk to you a little bit when we come back about Who's doing it? Is it the corporate giants, the easy targets? Is it little fragmented communities? And some examples of where and why. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. We're going to give you a lot more to think about when you come back.
Rich Fuller, president of the Blacksmith Institute, international organization attacking the world's toxicity problems. Please stay here with me. Lots more good stuff to share.
University of Arizona professor John Pollard asked the students in the Posada San Pedro Hall to consider bringing solar energy to the dorm. Just 3 years later, the Solar Cats, a group of students who took up the cause, have installed 44 solar panels on the dorm, saving 20,000 kilowatt hours of energy and reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 14 metric tons every year. Talk about students with a sunny future. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
She's the most exciting thing that's ever happened to you, and you want to spend eternity with her. She deserves nothing less than the best, an Abbott Taylor original. A diamond engagement ring as exceptional as she is that will make her eyes sparkle every time she sees it. Because we design and make our own jewelry, we can create something wonderful for every budget. I'm Abbott Taylor. I'd like to invite you to come see what Abbott Taylor Jewelers has waiting for you. With 35 years and thousands of original jewelry designs, no one has more experience in designing and making diamond jewelry in Tucson than Abbott Taylor Jewelers. We're proud to say using recycled gold, we have saved over 100 million pounds of toxic waste from this planet. Abbott Taylor Jewelers at 6383 East Grant Road, on Facebook and on the web at atdiamonds.com. Abbott Taylor Jewelers. Diamond designs for everyone. Abbott Taylor Jewelers.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. Did you know that the 2012 VW Beetle has been completely redesigned, that it has exciting new features, look, and performance, and that it is one of Oprah's best things for 2012? The best news is Chapman VW has them in stock. Check out the new Beetle at Chapman VW at 4600 East 22nd Street between Columbus and Swan, or visit them at TucsonVW.com. Be sure to tell them that Mrs. Green sent you.
You know how they say your donation to Goodwill changes lives?
Well, it's true.
It's true.
Well, it's true.
Goodwill.
Goodwill gave my son a chance.
My mom, hope.
My brother, a sense of purpose.
And help my dad find a job.
Goodwill helps thousands of people.
People like us every year.
People like us.
Every year.
Your donations to Goodwill do change lives. Please donate today.
Are you thinking about swapping out your old items for new? Think Habitat when you do. Don't trash it. Have a store it. Habitat for Humanity Tucson will resell your donated furniture, appliances, and building supplies and use the proceeds to build affordable homes in the greater Tucson area. Call now at 520-889-7200 for a free pickup. You can bring your donations to Habitat's Have a Store at 935 West Grant Road, just a quarter mile east of I-10. For more information, go to HabitatTucson.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And if you have just tuned in, get ready to think. We are interviewing Richard Fuller, who is president of the Blacksmith Institute, which is an international organization that basically there's a lot of components to it. They're committed to working with the world's most polluted places. They share resources and expertise with local groups and agencies to solve some of the biggest pollution problems on our planet today. And it's just in just kind of doing an inventory about how I'm feeling about this show. I need to sound a little more peppy because this is a really exciting topic, Rich, but it's daunting to me. I mean, it's you've got this very strong, thorough, kind of view from 100,000 feet. And as long as I've been doing this, it still amazes me how challenging the situation is in terms of global awareness and solutions to the problems. And people like you show up and I sleep better at night. So there you go. And doing my part to spread the good word. I want to talk about just a little part from the segment before, some of the places you go to, I imagine, have there's political volatility. Do you navigate that through the same, you know, global network you have of world leaders to say you have to let these people in, they're the good guys?
You know, the politics, when we're going in and doing a cleanup project, and we've done about 40 of these over the last 6 or 7 years, and there's, I think, 17 or 20 active right now, politics are the most difficult piece of it. In a lot of the countries we work, we've got really wonderful, deep, rich connections all throughout the political spectrum, and things can move very quickly. But in a lot of places, it's much more complicated than that. And we, you know, we have to be patient and wait until things move in the right direction. The technology and the cleanup work often is much easier. So a lot of that can be done with technologies that are reasonably straightforward. So, for example, we found a very contaminated place filled with heavy metals and PCBs in the middle of a village in India, in Gujarat. And it's about 2 acres of very contaminated land where industries had been dumping illegally, and it was feeding straight into the water supply. And the levels were extremely high. They're about 12,000 times what they should have been. What we did was, because India is actually a lovely place to work and they're very collaborative.
That's what I would think, yes.
They are. We dug up the worst of it and sent it off to a hazardous waste disposal site. And the stuff that was only about 1,000 times what it should be, we treated it with worms. And there's a technology you can use that uses a very large earthworm that when it digs through the soil, it will absorb the contaminants to the levels where when it gets sick, it will come back up to the surface and die.
You are kidding me.
It's an extraordinary, isn't it?
It is extraordinary.
And they dig down. They dig down about 3 meters and then come back up to the surface, and you just scrape them off, and that is very, very, very concentrated toxic waste. And after 3 or 4 sets of worms being sent down to their poor and sorry end, the soil is clean, and they're now growing crops on it.
Rich, I have to ask you this. I don't know if you know the answer, but who finds that out? Like, who says, oh, I know, if we put this certain kind of earthworm in there, it will go down and it'll come up and it will die and the earth will be clean. I mean, and I do know a lot about using earthworms for doing all kinds of great things to the soil. It's what's wrong with golf courses. They are all dead because of the pesticide levels. But tell me, who found that out? Do you have any idea?
Well, we had a local partner in the state who'd been trying it on a small scale, and he'd had some success with it. And he wanted to use this as a full-blown pilot for this particular work. And it worked great.
Well, it's what gives me hope for the planet, to be honest. It's like because these people are out there, there's hope for the planet because they're looking for solutions every day to overcome these challenges. So before we dropped the call, which is, you know, always annoys me, I have no idea what happened, I wanted to talk to you about it's so easy globally. And I do it, I admit it, to say, oh, it's probably BP that's doing that, or it's probably Shell. Take a shot at the corporate giants. And it's counterintuitive to me as an entrepreneur and a business owner. I don't like to take those shots. Who is it? Are they the easy targets? Are they some of the offenders? Or who's making the big messes?
It's not the big companies. You know, when we go out and assess sites, we don't care about who's responsible. We're just looking for a toxin.
A solution.
At levels that are dangerous.
Okay.
And we've got, you know, in our database now, 2,500 sites out there. And the big companies are less than 5 that show up with any responsibility associated with them. So there are a few places where the big companies are there. But the majority of these sites are one of 3 different categories. First of all, they're abandoned old factories that may have been owned by the state.
Right.
Think the Soviet Union and think all of their Mephistophelian old factories shut down, filled with toxins and never being cleaned up. That's one big category. The second are small, mid-sized kind of companies that are locally driven. It's, I hate to say it, we often say it's Mr. Wong from Hong Kong, mm-hmm, who's come across the border set up some factory, never had any pollution controls, may have been completely outside of the boundaries of the law, never been caught because they don't have the capacity to do that. And then they end up disappearing again and have left on some horrible pile of nasty. That's a very big piece of it. The third piece of it is people just trying to make a living. Local guys running small-scale activities, people who are, for example, recycling batteries in their backyard. We have many hundreds of locations where people will buy secondhand batteries. These are batteries that are dead. Car batteries, okay? Not double A's, but the big car batteries full of lead. And what they do is they take them down to the river or near the backyard or wherever else and take an axe to them and they split them open and the acid drains onto the ground. And then they take out the stuff inside and it's a gooey mix of metallic lead and lead oxide. And it's about 60% lead oxide. It's a kind of a gray goo. And that's the reason the battery has failed, is that it's mostly become lead oxide. And then they have a big frying pan or a wok, and they'll build a fire under it, often using burning tires. And they'll throw all that mix into that wok, and the lead will melt and sit at the bottom, and the lead oxide will float on the top. And that gray mess, they will scoop off and throw it on the ground, and then the lead, metallic lead, they'll pour into a small ingot and sell it. And they can make a few bucks from doing this because they'll buy the battery for, say, $10 and they'll get $15 worth of lead in an ingot out of it. But the problem is that lead oxide that they've thrown onto the ground, which is actually the bulk of the material, it's acutely toxic. And kids playing around their feet, of course, often kids on their backs, wrapped up in scarves, little babies will inhale that material. If they don't die, they'll be brain damaged. And these neighborhoods around these places are filled with mentally retarded children. And that happens in every urban center throughout the tropics. Every single urban center has dozens of these locations where that activity continues to go on. So this is one of the biggest sources of toxins. These are just people trying to make a living. They're not familiar with these problems, and they're just trying to make what they can. Similarly, if I can just give you another example.
Absolutely. This one, that one has to, like, land a little bit. It's, like, so unbelievable.
No,
it really does. It's like, whoa. Wow. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, batteries and battery recycling is really one of the biggest problems. By the way, just in terms of batteries here in the U.S., for those of us who are worried about our own children, all of the batteries here are collected and stored and sent to recycling facilities, most of them in the U.S., but some of them in Mexico. But those facilities are very well run and managed, and they don't pollute. They don't have anything significant that causes a problem for our kids. They're not backyard operations.
Right, right.
They're professionally run, well-controlled, managed by U.S. to U.S. standards or the Mexican standards, which are not too far off. They're not too bad.
If they're recycled. I mean, that's sometimes...
They are recycled.
It does.
99% of it's recycled.
Well, that's good news, too. Okay, so go ahead. Give another example. Oh, my goodness.
Another example is, well, also kind of, I don't know whether people know about this, but about 20% of all the gold that's mined in the world comes from small-scale guys who are panning for gold. And just think of, you know, the images of the gold rush out in the Yukon.
Right.
That's happening now in hundreds and hundreds of places all around the world. In almost every country in the world, there are these degraded areas where hundreds of people are out there staking claims, digging up dirt, and then extracting the gold as best they can and making a living from it. And there are literally 17 million people doing this around the world at any one time. Huge numbers of people. What they do, though, for most of the time, is they use mercury. And what they do is they'll pan the gold down to an amalgam, to a mix of stones and material that's has got as much gold as possible in it, and then they drip mercury into that mix. And mercury and gold have a kind of magical symbiosis in that gold will actually melt into the mercury and create an amalgam. So the gold sops up all the mercury but leaves everything else there intact. So they just pick up that glob of mercury and gold out of their pan and take it home. And here comes the bad bit. They then put a torch to it. They put a propane torch to it and boil off the mercury and end up with the raw gold left in their pan. And the mercury is boiled off, vaporizes into the air. About 70% of it floats through the community, goes into the lungs of the children who are watching the miracle of the gold appearing, of course.
Right, right.
And a good piece of it goes high into the atmosphere and ends up in our tuna fish.
Oh, my God. Talk about the food chain. Oh, my gosh.
The food chain, it comes all the way back to us. Now, here's the thing. Many people think now, when they do the numbers, that the largest source of mercury emissions in the world now is from this and not from coal-fired power plants. Coal-fired power plants have been improving over the last 3 or 4 years substantially. And this problem has gotten worse because the rise in the price of gold has encouraged so many more people to go out and do this work. And mercury is freely available and abundant and now used all over the world to do this.
And then they talk about the teeny tiny level of, in a CFL light bulb, and people have written to me about how could I recommend them, and you have to call in hazmat if you break a light bulb. And I'm thinking, yeah, come on over and listen to Rich Fuller from the Blacksmith Institute, and he's going to tell you about toxic waste challenges. I mean, it's so not funny. What blows me away, and it's really not my ego, I do a lot of research, and I do a lot of reading, and I am subscribed to so many informative educational publications in every area, and this one knocked my socks off. I had no idea about the challenges with mining gold and mercury poisoning. Certainly knew how poison mercury was. But once again, we are going to go to a short break, and I'm going to tell you if anything happens with our system, we'll call you right back, and I apologize, and I hope it doesn't. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. We are having a content-rich, informative show today with Rich Fuller, who's president of the Blacksmith Institute, and when we come back, we'll talk about some of the really and truly unbelievably great solutions and success stories. So please stay here with me. We'll be back in about 60 seconds, a little bit more.
Go deep underwater without getting wet. Study bugs like a real scientist. Make your shadow move in colors. These are just three reasons to visit the exciting hands-on new exhibits at the Children's Museum Tucson, the region's only museum just for kids. For 25 years, we've ignited kids' imaginations at the Children's Museum Tucson. That's something to celebrate. And admission is only $2 on the first Sunday and on the 25th of each month this whole year. Children's Museum Tucson, where imagination and learning connect.
Hi, this is Mrs. Green with some great news about the all-new 2012 VW Passat. It's 2012 Motor Trend Car of the Year, best-in-class for legroom, and has standard Bluetooth technology. VW thought of everything by giving the Passat a brand new sleek design that conveys confidence and assertiveness. If you're looking for the best ownership experience possible and a great new Passat, visit Chapman Tucson at 4600 East 22nd Street between Columbus and Swan.
What if you had simple and easy solutions to live, work, and play green? Green Living Magazine, the premier green lifestyle magazine, brings you the latest in organic cooking, gardening, health and wellness, chef and celebrity interviews, as well as easy solutions to clean up your everyday life. Visit greenlivingaz.com for the latest in green news. Buy your subscription and view our network videos. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, and again at greenlivingaz.com.
At the University of Arizona, we're putting solar know-how to work. And it's not just our researchers. Our students are on the job as well. Our student solar racing team, using recycled solar cells from NASA, designed and built a car from scratch that gets the equivalent of over 3,000 miles per gallon. Talk about students who will go far. Really, really far. The University of Arizona, big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, and certainly have given you a great deal to think about today. Our guest is Rich Fuller, who is the founder and president of the international, well-known, I am sure, Blacksmith Institute, totally committed to solving our toxic problems as a global community, working in some of the world's most polluted places. They share resources and expertise, and as I say frequently, they connect the big green dots and people. We're talking about the big green dots here. Rich, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you're still there.
I am. It's a pleasure.
Great. It's great. Okay. There are actually three things that I want to finish in this last segment, and one is totally random, but I want your opinion on it. So I'd love to talk to you about some of the solutions and success stories, because I love to, my world is one filled of hope, possibility, and change. And then how you're supported and how can people help. And then the last one is going to be, what does Rich Fuller think about the importance for your organization going forward of social media, because I did a little research on your social media presence. And the reason I ask that is because when I was deep in the jungles in Peru, in the rainforest, and I mean deep in the rainforest, the tribal leaders communicated by computers. They had generators. I'll never forget it. I spent 8 hours getting to a place in Peru, and the chief had a computer. And when I was in Costa Rica, really, really remote part of the rainforest, somebody had a cell phone that worked. So I don't mean social media in the sense of, you know, activating the Facebook network. So let's go to the first one. Lots of questions, I know, about solutions and what are you doing and what is your hope for the future in terms of this daunting challenge?
Well, once you start to narrow down what actually needs to happen, it doesn't seem that daunting. It's just a matter of being pragmatic and doing these projects one by one. So in each of these particular situations, there are successful strategies that stop people from getting killed from these toxins. So, for example, with the battery project, we had a contaminated site in the Dominican Republic, just outside of the capital of Santo Domingo. And up in the hills, there are about in another urban area just outside of the city, there are about 50,000 people who are being exposed to lead that was extremely high levels. And we spend a total of about $150,000 and dug it up and put it away into a place that no one can get to. It kept it away safe in a protected area, and trained and tested all of the children, treated the worst of the children, and are continuing to test them all, and turned the place into a baseball park.
Oh, my goodness.
And you know, it's just a very nice, straightforward solution that ends up protecting that community forever. So, you know, we've got lots and lots of examples of having been successful in doing this in many, many places for quite inexpensive amounts of money. And that's how I think this needs to be tackled. Site by site, building collaborations with national and local governments and institutions in each of these countries. And just going through the process of fixing and cleaning up the worst of these places one by one. And we'll focus our own resources on those places that are the absolute worst, you know, places where kids are dying every day, or where, you know, life expectancy is some abysmal level. There is good value in this.
So with the battery example, that's a perfect one. You talked about the importance of the livelihood for the people that are doing it. They need to earn money. This is a way. When you teach them safer practices, is it involving still being able to use the batteries, break them down, and still get an income from them? Or do you have to say, in some cases, there's not the capacity to do that, we're going to ship the batteries, but we can teach you other ways to earn a living? I mean, what happens there?
In this particular site in Santo Domingo, it was an abandoned site, and the batteries were being processed in a much cleaner facility in an industrial park.
Okay.
And it was this abandoned site that was causing the problem. We did another cleanup of a similar sort in Dakar in Senegal, 2 years ago, and it was an active place where people were continuing to break down batteries. What we've done is we've set up a collection center where those folk now, instead of collecting the batteries and breaking them open, are collecting them and reselling them to someone who's treating them appropriately and taking them to a clean center.
Okay.
And they get actually a little bit more money than they used to by doing this. So it was just a matter of setting up the logistics of helping them to build a center and making sure they had the right contracts in place to be able to do this.
And not to be cliche, but that's a sustainable solution because you have to make sure people take care of their, you know, putting food on the table and staying alive in other ways. So that's a great example. What are some of the other, just give us one really great success story that you're most excited about, and also typically how long does a project take from when you go in, or is there such a thing as a typical time frame from start to finish for your participation?
We classify projects into small, medium, and large, and small projects are ones like these two I've described with lead battery. And they're not that expensive. They're less than $250,000 of total cost, and they can be done in 12 months or so. The projects that are large and are ones that end up requiring millions of dollars of investment, and generally we're not the ones who are directing those levels of monies. It's the World Bank,
right,
or the Asian Development Bank or someone like that whom we partner with very closely. So one that we worked in Africa, in Zambia, a whole town, the second largest town in Zambia, is massively contaminated from an old lead smelter. Coincidentally, this is also another lead story, but not from batteries. This is actually a place where they used to mine lead for almost 100 years with no pollution controls whatsoever. And the average IQ in this town is around 80.
Oh, my God.
Simply because of all of the lead poisoning that goes on there.
Right.
So the World Bank brought in originally $20 million as a result of our intervention, eventually about $45 million, and have been cleaning up the worst of the places, putting in great health and education processes, and are making that town now a safer place to live. And we've been there coordinating and helping them through the whole process. So having partners like that really helps.
Yeah, a long-term solution. Well, one of the things I asked in that myriad of questions back in the second segment is, what makes you decide at the Blacksmith Institute to say yay or nay to working on a project? I'm sure that I would think you'd have far more submissions to come help us than you do the time and the manpower and the dollars to respond. How do you decide?
Well, we do, and a lot of it's to do with where we can find resources. We get grants from some of these international agencies, but they're generally specific to one particular project.
Right.
And what we rely on in order to go out and fix the problems that are the most compelling, those places that are just terrifyingly awful, are donations from the general public. And, you know, the more that we can get $20,000 to go out and look at a place that we've heard about that sounds horrific and start work and then bring in the World Bank for the $2 million next step, it's that initial seed money that we need to be able to do that. So we really look to, you know, getting small grants, small donations, and the rest from the general public to go and start that work.
So your donors, I mean, it's just a basic
model. Our donors are critical.
Our donors. Yeah. It really, I mean, it just does really work. And it just, like I said, the magnitude and scope of it. So do you want to give me a little bit of the Rich Fuller's idea about the use of social media? And I don't mean it just in terms of, I think for donor development, I can see that. I read statistics on Facebook as of 2 days ago, and regardless of what people think, the numbers of people actively involved in Facebook are still continuing to grow. And I thought everybody was suffering from Facebook fatigue, but they're not. So there's the donor development, stay in touch with people that certainly our younger generation is turning to, and Twitter, you know, all of those things. But then there's the information sharing, and I can use the NRDC as a perfect example, or Environmental Working Group, or GRIST. I go to those sites on Facebook for information on a global scale because I want to have an international picture. What do you see for the Blacksmith Institute on both sides, the donor development and the sharing of information and education?
I must admit we're not great at this. We have a Facebook page. We do Twitter, but it's reasonably irregular. Our Facebook page is updated perhaps once a day or twice a week or so, and we have a blog and so on. But we've never found that this is a place that people have found out terribly much about us, because I think this is a new area that people are just beginning to understand. So for us, from our perspective, we'll continue to do that work and continue to develop those avenues to find, you know, people who are interested in this effort and need to be educated and perhaps might be interested in providing some small resources that we can leverage into much larger resources. But it's a complicated area from our perspective to do this. And remember, you know, my personal background is that of an engineer. So I don't I think we need to find someone who can help us to navigate this social network a little bit.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's uncharted waters, and I read a lot because I am an integrated social media platform for sustainability. So it's my job, but it's not easy. Even with looking at it and with the team of people that I have helping me, you don't want to just be another voice out there. And how do you do your branding where it's effective and spend money, staff time, in targeting the group that you want to reach? So I understand, and I also don't think it's for everybody. I think there's something really great having been on boards of nonprofits, the good old donor development, and reaching out to people to develop and nurture your donor base. Those good old-fashioned techniques still work, in my opinion, from what I see in the charities that I'm still involved in. It's, you know, let's not switch to Facebook. Let's keep those connections that you nurture and build to help build your donor base. So I agree with you. It's a monster that has to be fed every day feeding it. So yeah. Do you have another example? I'm very interested in some of the things. I know that you do convene world meetings, and I'm interested, very intrigued by what you said about Russia, going back to that piece, because, you know, there was Russia, and now there are shockingly developing countries in what was one of the greatest world powers. When the infrastructure was eliminated, what do you see in terms of your focus on Russia today and on a go-forward basis?
Russia is filled with some of the most toxic hotspots in the world. I would think that if we were to honestly categorize which are the very worst places in the world, that probably 60% of them are in the former Soviet Union. For example, there's one that we're working on in the Ukraine right now. It's in the eastern part near a town called Donetsk, where they just, by the way, held some of the European Union Cup soccer finals. And about 30 miles away, there's a small town called Gorlovka, where they made TNT all through World War II. They made about 60% of all the TNT that was used in the bombs. And they use a very dirty process that's not used in the U.S. that has an intermediary called mononitrochlorobenzene. And this stuff is acutely toxic. It's got a, you know, if you take more than half a teaspoon, you're dead. And they made something like 2,000 tons of this material without ever turning it into TNT, and left it in under tarpaulins in the back of the factory until it was closed down. And that was 10 years ago. This stuff has been leaking into the groundwater. It's in all the streams. It's killed people miles away just by leaching into the groundwater and going into their coal mines in distant areas. It's massively toxic. And they left also another couple of tons of TNT in the pipes of the factory when they shut it down. So the factory, if you can imagine it, it's a complex of a dozen buildings, two or three stories tall, now completely dark with the roofs falling in, filled with TNT.
Oh my God.
And thousands of tons of this most toxic material you can imagine, all of it in the center of town, of a town of 50,000 people. So there are some places no one should visit, and that's one of them.
And I guarantee you that the most of the United States of America and the citizens in the U.S. have no clue. I mean, it blows me away. On your website, there is an unbelievable button or a click, because your website is, to me, over the top, extraordinary, exceptional. It's easy to navigate. It's interactive. So when you talk about social media ratings, you would get a 5-star from Mrs. Green on that one. But 10 places you don't want to visit. And I don't know if you know this, but you also put that on Twitter to avoid. I mean, people that are traveling, that are going all over and wanting to go to Russia, wanting to go into China, wanting to go into Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam, they should check out your site, because it will be very, I mean, it could be life-saving for them. And, you know, before the downfall of the Soviet Union, were people just living there and dying? Was that it? I mean, so who cares? And it wasn't known because they had such control on the press? Or was it because they were abandoned that it's become such a toxic challenge?
It's also a kind of part of the Russian mentality that vodka is fine and we're going to die, so why not get drunk?
Oh, my God, that's so sad.
There is kind of a defeatist attitude there. And there, in many of these places, the value that we hold life is much degraded comparative to our own levels of understanding. So, you know, where governments put their focus is just in different areas than we would. So there's a lot of work for the international community to have some kind of standards in that area as well.
Yeah, I know. And there's got to be a reason, and I think it's obvious about, are there enough groups watchdogging what's going on in the United States? Because I still think we have major challenges, not comparatively speaking to some of the things you just mentioned in Russia, but there are, you know, I know a lot about the uranium mines in the northern part of our state, and there's still challenges. You're looking at the globe, and we can count on the local agencies and national agencies to help us here.
Yes. Now the problems in the U.S. are still there. It's just that the magnitude of them overseas is
so much greater.
Yeah.
You know,
I think it behoves us to consider ourselves citizens of the world and look at the whole scope of it all. Yeah.
I totally do. There's a global community, and that's it. Rich, you were a great guest, and I don't know about that glitch, but so much of what you had to say will be used by the team at Mrs. Green's World to move the globe forward. Thank you for being a part of the show and taking the time. I know how busy you are. So this was the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. Thank you for being a part of it. Podcast available within 2 days. Rich Fuller from the Blacksmith Institute.